Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona. Now, I want to thank all of you for tuning in this evening. You are going to learn a lot tonight, as usual, on the Hour of the Time. Now, if you'd like to contact us, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, or HOT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com. That's hourofthetime.com. The studio number, 928-333-2942. And my personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, go ahead and use the studio number, ladies and gentlemen, or the email to contact me with research, questions, comments, complaints, what have you. Just please be to the point. I don't need your whole life story to answer eventually a simple question of what's the zip code or something like that, and that happens quite a bit. So give me contact information. Don't just ask a question and hang up because I can't answer it. Or email me, which is the best way if you have the ability to use email, because then I can read it and answer you point by point, make sure I don't miss anything, and then it's saved in your email, and you can go over the answers multiple times if you don't understand them. Now, we're going to do another blast from the past tonight, and this is very important information. This is only a drop in the bucket this week of what we have here in our archives. It was bequeathed to me by a wonderful couple who had a vast research library. They had been collecting this library and studying this and working against the World Socialist Movement since the 1930s. So I was fortunate to be guided through this very issue of world governance, its threat, world communism, tyranny, step by step, through the years, with books that most people have never heard of, you can't hardly find them, and given truly an education, and then given all this as a tool for me to carry on the fight, and that's what we do here at the Hour of the Time, and we use facts to back everything up, not the newest email rumor, which is quite popular among radio talk show hosts. It's much easier to do a ad hoc show for 3-4 hours when 70% of it is hack rate commercials from most of them bad companies as far as our freedom agenda is concerned, and then just spread rumors, because then it's real easy to fill up 3 hours time. I'd rather give you an hour of hardcore research and background information that you can go check out, reference, and cite on your own, and become educated, because you must know the enemy, ladies and gentlemen. And if you don't know the enemy, you will lose. Does a military, in a correct situation, I'm going to make sure in light of some of today's events, we qualify that, do they sit back and wait till they're attacked and defeated to then say, oh, we better find something out about the enemy, his intelligence capabilities, his air power, his ground movements, his forces, his supplies? No, you do your research ahead of time so that you're ready to counter the enemy's every move. You must know your enemy as well as they know themselves, ladies and gentlemen. Subscribe to their literature. Keep in mind, it's propaganda. Keep in mind the socialist conspiracy around the world are masters of propaganda. They're the ones who wrote the book. And they'll make you feel good and accept ideas. So keep that in mind, but read their own works. Now, before we get into this classic recording, in tonight's broadcast, I would call, in light of what I'm going to give you here from myself and some research, and this classic recording, tonight's would be called the United Nations Hoax, if you wanted to reference something. But I'm going to read to you and give you some insight into some various reports here first. I have told you that the property rights and land issue is the tool for world government. They don't need to use world religion, because how are they getting the world religion summits and conventions like the Southern Baptist Convention, the Catholic Convention, to get on board with each other? They are using the environment, again, bringing it up in the conventions, saying that this is something we all need to key in on and unite on. If you control the environment and the rights to private property, you control production, travel, movement, prosperity, or lack of it. You can control famines, as in institute them. You control the very population. Now I want to read you something from their side to prove what I'm saying. Go check it out. And I'm going to take it, predominantly from four sources. Our global neighborhood, Maurice Strong, known communist, his Stockholm to Rio, a journey down a generation. Our global neighborhood, again, report of the Commission on Global Governance. And Renewing the United Nations, a Program for Reform, report of the Secretary General. Now, on July 14th, ladies and gentlemen, of 1997, Kofi Annan, he released Maurice Strong's initial plan to begin reforming, or restructuring, is what you should read, the United Nations. Okay, now Maurice Strong is a known world communist, so is Kofi Annan. This 95-page document was entitled, as I referenced, Renewing the United Nations, a Program for Reform, and it's a step-by-step program to implement the recommendations that have been advanced by the UN-funded Commission on Global Governance. And the UN-funded Commission on Global Governance in 1995 released a report entitled Our Global Neighborhood. Maurice Strong, is a member of the Commission on Global Governance and a lead author of the very report. So none of this should come as a surprise to anybody doing their research. He was the first appointment of Kofi Annan just days after Annan was selected as UN Secretary General. And as executive coordinator for reform, Strong was hired specifically to restructure the sprawling UN system into the mechanism for global governments described in our global neighborhood. Now remember, the global neighborhood comes from the UN-funded Commission on Global Governance. Now, it of course was welcomed with open arms in Washington. And the big hype that you heard on the news media and how good Kofi Annan, as Secretary General, was doing was that it promised to eliminate a whopping 1,000 staff positions and reduce overhead costs by 25 to 38%. But little or no attention was ever paid by most people to the effect of the reform plan on the very structure and intent of the institution. And by that I mean they came out blatantly stating their goals. Now, their very report said at the time, and no one covered it, except for Hour of the Time, that reform is not intrinsically an exercise in cutting cost or reducing staff. It's an exercise to assure the organization's relevance in a changing world. Now again, I'm going to prove to you again, the environment, control of property rights, is the tool towards global government and tyranny. And they themselves, later on, I'm going to quote them, even say it's not going to be UN Black Hawk helicopters with troops. They don't need to use that, nor would it be effective. They don't have enough because of people like us and people that we support and teach that are well-armed and members of the proper militia. Now, this relevance issue that they speak about is probably the understatement of the century. It is a fundamental shift, officially announced finally, of the very purpose and existence of the United Nations. The very market, if you will, and it could be called that, or service areas of the United Nations is shifting openly per their own admittal, finally, away from issues dealing with sovereign nations and dealing directly to the people and citizens of those nations themselves. That's right. That's one of the steps. Absolution of individual nation states, ladies and gentlemen. The UN is no longer limiting its activities to providing just services for nations, but gearing up to provide security for the people, that's a quote from the report, within those nations. If they don't acknowledge the individual nation states, to them, they don't exist. And really, this UN reform package really was the final step, and we covered it at the time, but a lot of you need a re-education, obviously, a refresher course. There's nothing wrong with that. That's why we play these old recordings from the 50s and 40s so you can get the very foundations of the threat. But they redefined the very meaning of the term security. In the charter, they refer to collective security, which is agreement among nations not to use force against each other and to defend each other from external attack. Now, collective security evolved into comprehensive security during the 1980s, and it embraced the idea of disarmament, demobilization, and demilitarization. And the final step, which they openly admitted for the millennium, was the human security aspect, which included all the above, and quote, safety from chronic threats such as hunger, disease, and repression, as well as protection from sudden and harmful disruptions in the patterns of daily life. Ordo ab chao, ladies and gentlemen, order out of chaos. Now, is there a conflict, ladies and gentlemen, obviously, between the UN's determination to provide human security to individual citizens within sovereign states and a country's national sovereignty? Definitely so. But guess what? Maurice Strong, known communist, and the Commission on Global Governance has the fix. Now, from our global neighborhood, here's a few quotes. Countries are having to accept that in certain fields, sovereignty has to be exercised collectively, particularly in respect of the global commons. And the principle of sovereignty must be further adapted to recognize changing realities. Quote, there is a need to weigh a state's rights to autonomy against its people's rights to security. And another one, it is time to begin thinking about self-determination in a new context. The emerging context of a global neighborhood rather than the traditional context of a world of separate states, and the concept of national sovereignty has been immutable, indeed a sacred principle of international relations. It is a principle which will yield only slowly and reluctantly to the new imperatives of global environmental cooperation. What is needed is recognition of the reality that it is simply not feasible for sovereignty to be exercised by individual nation states, however powerful. Stockholm to Rio, A Journey Down a Generation by Maurice Strong, known communist. He says that national sovereignty is an obsolete concept, and he is one of the main ramrods, Maurice Strong, for getting rid of it. Now, it's officially underway, ladies and gentlemen, and it will only stop if you stop it. Now, there's going to be immediate consequences, and right now they're in preparatory stages by their own admittal for, quote, more sweeping changes in the future as the world succumbs to the tightening grip of global governance. The immediate changes have been the International Criminal Court, an assembly of the people, as they put it. Doesn't it sound all warm and fuzzy? A petitions council. A complete restructuring of the trusteeship council. The International Criminal Court, which has been around for many years in theory and in practice and in rehearsals and dry runs, is in effect. Point blank. It has its own panel of prosecutors. And it was sold originally as the idea to prosecute war criminals. And in our global neighborhood, they say how they need to change and focus on the context of international law in general, exercising its prosecutorial powers within the sovereign borders of states without interference from national, state, or local governments. The very essence of global governments is the capacity of the international community to ensure compliance with the rules of society. That's a quote, ladies and gentlemen, again from our global neighborhood. Now this, at this millennium kickoff, by the way, which was 300 or so selected representatives of that many number of non-government organizations, accredited, of course, by the United Nations, they kicked off their new concepts after the new millennium in the year 2000. And the function of the Assembly of the People was to provide direct input to the General Assembly from representatives of civil society. Now they have a new early warning system, which they call the Petitions Council, in which more non-government organizations, again non-representatives of any of the people of individual nation states, get to do a petition process to route the cause and effect and need to the appropriate UN agency, no matter where in the world this event comes up. Now, let me tell you something about the Trusteeship Council. It was to theoretically oversee the transition of colonies to global governments nations. Global Commons replaced all of that, and that's their word, to be defined as, quote, the atmosphere, outer space, the oceans beyond national jurisdiction, and the related environment and life support systems that contribute to the support of human life. Now, UNEP, which is the United Nations Environmental Program, has incorporated the United Nations Center for Human Settlements, known as the acronym HABITAT. All environmental treaties, which will be their tool, and there's more than 300 now, will become the implementation and enforcement arm for the UN Trusteeship Program and the United Nations Environmental Program in itself. the United Nations Development Fund, into which is also included the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, and the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA. The reform process, ladies and gentlemen, again, right here by their own admittal, using the environment to reach global governments and population control. And they have four key areas which they tie the environment into every time. And from their own literature, those are the core mission being peace and security, economic and social affairs, development cooperation, humanitarian affairs, and human rights. And the fifth area, the human rights issue tied to the environment, of course, is considered by the UN itself in their own writing here to cover all of the over 130 UN agencies, commissions, committees, and funds. And they created a new senior management staff recently to head these new departments. Now they're moving into, and they have been, but they're making it more aggressive, the move to where every nation where there is any sort of UN presence, whether you're a member or not, and being a member is also the UN presence, so they've got about everybody covered, under the authority of the Special Representative, the Secretary General. And all of these activities will be ultimately in their special facility that they call their UN house. That's their own words, I'm not making it up. And under a single flag for all nations where they have UN presence or their member states of the United Nations. A single flag, and that being the UN flag. Now, South Africa got the first UN house, just so you know. Now, they also cover, under the Peace and Security Department, using the environment, again, as their tool, in their own words right here, three other areas and three sub-departments, political affairs, peacekeeping operations, and disarmament and arms regulations. Keep that in mind, ladies and gentlemen. And they say, point blank, quote, global security can be said to exist only if the Security Council of the United Nations can dispatch military forces rapidly and with the requisite predictability and reliability by handling their own forces. And UNIDIR, which is the United Nations Institute for Disarmament Research, and, by the way, United Nations Conference on Disarmament, and they meet 3 to 4 months every year in Geneva, just so you know, will be all consolidated under this new Department of Disarmament and Arms Regulation, all controlled and headed out of Geneva. And their objective is to ultimately control all firearms. Quote, the production and trade in arms should be controlled by the international community. Military force is not a legitimate political instrument except in self-defense or under UN auspices. End quote. And that's from our global neighborhood. And that's a report on the Commission of Global Governance. And again, remember where it all started and where all the funding comes from and all the sacrifices come from, ladies and gentlemen. It all comes from the environmental issues. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the United Nations, through its program of reform, are preparing for implementation of a new concept of security for the people. And from their program and commission on global governments, quote, the concept of global security must be broadened from the traditional focus of security of states to include the security of people and the security of the planet. The United Nations, through its program of reform, is becoming both the protector and provider for the world. They've determined that their institution of global governments must be responsible for not only the security of the people, but must be prepared to redefine national sovereignty, demilitarize all national capabilities, disregard the protest of what they term uncivil society, or in other words, organizations not accredited by the United Nations, because that was their definition of civil society. Ha ha ha. See where we're going? And it's underway. And it's not just a reformation of the UN, it's of all societies, ladies and gentlemen, are being affected by it. Most members of Congress and Senate and the Clinton and Gore administration and the Bush administration have had given their blessings and given staunch assistance to this plan, ladies and gentlemen. And from their own reports, the Reformation is not accompanied by black helicopters delivering UN soldiers. It is being actively promoted through the UN Convention on Climate Change, the Convention on Biological Diversity, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Convention on the Land of the Sea, Law of the Sea, the Convention on Chemical Weapons, the Convention on International Criminal Court, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the Convention on World Heritage Sites, the UN Worldwide Biosphere Reserve Network, the Ramsar Convention on Wetlands, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, the Ecosystem Management Policy, the American Heritage Rivers Initiative, the Sustainable Communities Initiative, and a host of other UN policies that now dominate domestic policy in the United States. That's their words, not mine, ladies and gentlemen. Every one of them using the environment to lead us to global government. And the very issue of property rights, whether that be property of a state, property of a nation, or property of an individual. And they say themselves that from the year 2000, enough of the policies are in place and sufficient restructuring of the UN has been accomplished to claim that global governance is a new reality, a reality from which there is no escape. Oh, I beg to differ about the no escape thing, ladies and gentlemen. But this is all new information to many of you. Go check it out. Check out the quotes, the references. I gave you the years, the dates, the people, the reports. Now, the blast from the past. And again, we could call tonight, if you want to reference it for whatever reason, the United Nations hoax. And I think you're going to like this old recording. This is an oldie. And this gentleman studied intensely UNESCO and the United Nations and saw right from the get-go that it was simply a tool of the world socialist and communist movement.
Few Americans know that in a matter of weeks after our United States financed an abortive invasion attempt to oust the red dictator Castro from his Cuban stronghold, we actually paid him the equivalent of about $463,000 for economic development. Thus, after spending $45 million of your dollars and mine in an invasion attempt that apparently was not intended to succeed, we're asked to cough up another $463,000 to put Castro back on his feet so that he will be in a better position to assist the final Sovietization of our nation. Now, such backhanded economics could only happen in the befuddled, clouded, and confused brains of our ultra-liberal politicians. Were it necessary for the appropriation of $463,000 to pass the vote of Congress, it would have received strong opposition from senators of both parties and would have raised a vicious outcry from citizens across the land. But the insane investment is a legacy of our United Nations participation, and we're helpless to stop it as long as we remain a member. In reality, the entire United Nations grant to Cuba amounted to $1,157,600. and was in response to Castro's request for aid in financing experts and consultants for equipment and fellowships. Since the United States pays about 40% of the expenses of the United Nations, we therefore contributed about $463,000 of the total. It was Senator Pat McGowan who said, "Until my dying day, I will regret signing the United Nations Charter." Now, clear-thinking Americans have seen that the signing of the UN Charter has unrelentingly brought that day of death within tragic view, not only for our nation, but for us as individuals, through the widespread extension of the communist conspiracy. The United Nations, which severely threatens the sovereignty of our nation, was conceived in subterfuge and was clearly the result of careful Kremlin planning. The collective security idea of the United Nations was promoted in the Communist Daily Worker, December 22, 1937, where they said, and I quote, "Put pressure on Congress for immediate collective security policy." The Daily Worker issue of January 6, 1936 said, "The real issue is collective security before it is too late." Having manipulated their man, Alger Hiss, into position, the United Nations plan was drafted at the Dumbarton Oaks Conference in 1944. Hiss was the executive secretary of this hush-hush affair at which the press and the public were excluded. He was also the top man in the State Department on United Nations planning. Alger Hiss was also the most influential man at the 1945 Yalta Conference. During the fight over the Kremlin's demand for 16 votes in the United Nations to our one, Roosevelt, Hiss, Stalin, and Charles Bolin were left alone in a conference room to thrash out the problem. When Roosevelt came out of the room, accompanied by Alger Hiss, he told his advisors that an agreement had been reached which would give the Soviets 3 votes to our one in the General Assembly of the United Nations. Over the protests of the American delegation, President Roosevelt said, "I know I shouldn't have done it, but I was so tired when they got hold of me." Who were they? The only other persons in the room were Stalin, Hiss, and Bolin. But the line of communist influence does not end there. Harry Dexter White represented the Treasury Department at San Francisco and served as chairman of the commission which established the International Monetary Fund, the United Nations agency. Later, White became U.S. Executive Secretary of the Fund in spite of FBI warnings to the White House that he, White, was a Soviet agent. The major speech at the San Francisco meetings by Secretary Stettinius was written in a large part by Dalton Trumbo, one of the Hollywood 10 later indicted for refusing to answer questions regarding his connections with a communist conspiracy. Many well-informed persons have reason to believe that the United Nations Charter was written by Alger Hiss and Molotov. In essence, it is taken almost entirely from the phony constitution of the Soviet Union. Communist publications are not news reporting agencies as such. They print only the news which is helpful to the international Kremlin conspiracy, and they write that news in a distorted, ultra-biased vein. That the United Nations was viewed by the communists as one of the major tools toward ultimate world domination is attested to by the strength with which they backed the United Nations move within the United States. Their April 1945 issue of Political Affairs told the Communist Party, and I quote, "Great popular support and enthusiasm for the United Nations policies should be built up, well organized and fully articulate. But it is also necessary to do more than that. The opposition must be rendered so impotent that it will be unable to gather any significant support in the Senate against the United Nations Charter and the treaties which will follow." End of quote. Communist influence was strong in the conception of the United Nations and was carried over into the maintenance of it. The New York Grand Jury and the Senate Security Subcommittee investigations during 1952 and 1953 provided conclusive proof that Alger Hiss was highly successful in getting Kremlin sympathizers on the United States on payroll in the United Nations. Chesley Manley, in his book, The 20-Year Revolution, said, "Hiss clandestinely recommended job seekers to his friends who already held influential positions in the United Nations Secretariat. According to the report of the Judiciary Subcommittee, Hiss secretly recommended 500 persons for United Nations employment. Many of them were employed, and some of them later became public issues, the subcommittee reported. The public issues referred to had refused, on the ground of self-incrimination, to tell the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee whether they were or had been communists, or were engaging or had engaged in espionage or subversive. Regard security information regarding soil. The Soviet Union did this so that it could use the United Nations as a vast base of espionage on the American continent and operate under the cover of diplomatic immunity. End of quote. The Committee on the Judiciary, in their report, Exposé of Soviet Espionage, May 1960, said concerning the subversive activities of members of the Soviet Embassy and the United Nations, quote, as of February 1960, the press department of the Soviet Embassy was distributing press releases to almost 7,000 individuals and institutions of the United States, including newspaper editors, business leaders, radio stations, public libraries, television stations, teachers, labor leaders, scientists, and leaders in trade and commerce. In addition, since January 1, 1959, 30 different officials attached to the Soviet Embassy have made or were scheduled to make 74 public appearances before various groups in this country. 19 other Soviets attached to the Soviet delegation to the United Nations Secretariat or assigned to Inturist made or were scheduled to make 39 public appearances during the same period. These public appearances usually involved speeches or participation in forums on the part of the Soviet official and were made before various types of groups, including high school, college and university groups, parent-teacher associations, advertisement and civic clubs, fraternities, professional associations or clubs, religious or cultural groups, travel clubs, and community centers. Some of these were television appearances. It is apparent that the Soviets are taking every opportunity to spread the gospel of communism by exploitation of the intense desire of Americans to learn more about the Soviet Union. End of quote. Now the United States, through the United Nations, is rapidly losing its sovereignty. United Nations propagandists assert that the increasing number of nations in the United Nations is proof of the growth of democracy and a major contributing factor in the cause of world peace. However, they fail to remind themselves and others that during the United Nations' lifespan, the international communist conspiracy has grown from a slave empire of about 250 million to almost 1 billion. A tragic indictment against the Kremlin peace line and those gullible eggheads who have swallowed it. In the United Nations, the United States is allowed one vote. The Kremlin was allowed three votes, thanks to the conniving of Hiss and his cohorts. But in addition to this, the communist conspiracy has the vote of six captive nations, which gives them nine votes to our one. Any statement to the contrary displays an ignorance of communist politics. The captive nations vote as the Kremlin dictates. Since the forming of the United Nations, 48 new nations have been added, bringing the total to 99 as of October 1960. Included in these recent admissions to the United Nations were 13 newly created African nations, most of which were only slightly removed from cannibalism, and which have strong pro-communist leanings. Each of these semi-civilized states has an equal voice with the United States in the United Nations. The full portent of this fact can be derived from an Associated Press report of October 8, 1960. I quote, "One of the most striking things about Saturday's General Assembly vote on Red China was U.S. failure to win a single vote from 16 new United Nations members. 13 of the new countries abstained, that is, took neither side. Three backed Soviet demands for action towards seating the Beijing regime. Some diplomats had privately forecast a political setback for the United States, but few, if any, had predicted that the Africans would fail to rally at least a few votes behind the hard-pushed U.S. drive to sidetrack the China issue question. Western delegates generally had expected that Nigeria, a newly independent former British territory, would line up in the Western camp. It voted on the communist side. The others were Mali and Senegal, both former French colonies. In 1952, 85% of the United Nations member nations voted with the United States against the admission of Red China to the United Nations. In 1960, only 56% supported the United States position. There were 22 abstentions. A change of a few of these to the Kremlin's position would result in Red China's admission and thus accomplish a key objective of the conspiracy. Add to this United Nations Ambassador Stevenson's remark that the Red China admission is inevitable, and the National Council of Churches' resolution that the United States subordinate its will to that of the United Nations, and you face a landslide toward the entire sellout of American sovereignty. The character of the United Nations is essentially hypocritical. It has been instrumental in decrying the colonialism of Western nations while fostering increased communist colonialism. On November the 28th, 1960, British Minister of State David Ormsby Gore told the United Nations General Assembly that since 1939, Britain had granted independence to 500 million people, while in the same period, the Soviet Union had incorporated all or part of six countries with a population of 22 million, completing its present colonial rule over almost 1 billion people. This British charge brought a quick protest from Soviet Deputy Foreign Minister Zorin. Zorin demanded that Assembly President Frederick H. Bolin halt what he called interference in the Soviets' internal affairs. Bolin complied and urged all delegates to refrain from inflammatory attacks. Of course, attacks are not inflammatory when they're made by communist conspiracy delegates in the United Nations against the United States or the other nations of the free world. Let us look a little further into this question of United Nations hypocrisy. During November 1960, the attacks against the Belgian government had become so strong that Belgium threatened to withdraw from the United Nations unless United Nations officials ceased attacks on their government. Of course, running concurrently with the attacks on the Belgian government were attacks on the anti-communist government leaders and provinces in the Congo. An appropriate answer to these attacks was given by Minister Monongo of Katanga Province in the Congo. Mr. Monongo said, "Have the United Nations ever worried about the opposition leaders executed in other countries in South America? Did the United Nations worry about the killing of King Faisal of Iraq? What have the United Nations done to protect tens of thousands of Balubas and Kasai who were exterminated by Lumumbas? Have the United Nations opened an inquest on the poisoning of the leader of the Cameroons in Switzerland? Have the United Nations worried about millions of Russians exterminated in Russia? Why didn't the United Nations protect General Mileta and Premier Imre Nagy in Hungary? Is it not true that the Allies in the war allowed their friend General Mihailovic to be executed by Tito?" There is no end to questions like this. Those I have put to shame the United Nations, which does not say a word when big powers are involved, but likes to enforce itself and its pretended authority when it is dealing with a small, feeble nation. The United Nations forgets some things, but likes to make hypocritical clamor about individuals who are not worth worrying about. End of quote. These questions, vital to the free peoples of the world, demand a satisfactory answer from officials of the United Nations and their apologists, both here and abroad. Many prominent United States and world officials have spoken out in violent opposition to the United Nations. On April 18, 1960, our newspapers reported General Mark W. Clark, former United Nations commander in Korea, says this country should withdraw from the United Nations because no useful purpose is served by the United States being a member. General de Gaulle said the United Nations offers no more than tumultuous and scandalous sessions where it is impossible to organize objective debate and which are filled with invective delivered by the communists and their allies. The result is that in the Congo, the United Nations carries to the spot its global incoherence. In these conditions, France does not see how she can take any other attitude toward the United Nations or the disunited nations than that of the greatest reserve. In any case, she does not want to participate either through her manpower or through her finances to any current or eventual enterprise of this organization or disorganization. We hope the day will come when common sense will prevail and where reasonable nations, seeing where this experiment has led them, will put this great global organization on a new foundation. End of quote. A nucleus of such a new foundation, as suggested by General de Gaulle and echoed by militant anti-communists everywhere, is already established. The Asian People's Anti-Communist League held its 7th annual convention in Manila in May of 1961. Attending the convention were 19 member nations, including the Republic of China, Korea, Philippines, Thailand, Vietnam, Japan, Australia, and many others. In addition, more than 60 delegates and observers from 35 nations and territories, including many from the newly independent African countries, were in attendance. The Asian People's Anti-Communist League is a non-governmental organization established in Korea in 1954. It has as its aim the promotion of unity of freedom-loving peoples of Asia, the furtherance of international friendship, and the coordination of worldwide anti-communist efforts. The United States pays approximately 40% of the cost of the United Nations. For this, we are receiving an ever-expanding communist slave empire, the verbal propaganda invectives of the Kremlin and her stooges, the ultimate loss of our national sovereignty, and the communist-dominated slave camps which will accompany our surrender. It is only common sense, then, to unite with free nations who have a common purpose and face a common enemy. It is my belief that our only survival is that we either reorganize the United Nations, excluding the Soviet Union and the communist satellites, or we get out of the United Nations and get the United Nations out of the United States. Nothing short of this will save the free world or the freedoms enjoyed by the people in the United States. There is no question as to the intent of the founding fathers of the United States. In the Mayflower Compact, they wrote these inspired words, "In the name of God, amen. We whose names are underwritten, having undertaken for the glory of God and advancement of the Christian faith, do by these presents, solemnly and mutually, in the presence of God and one another, covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body politic, for our better ordering and preservation and furtherance of the ends aforesaid." Woodrow Wilson said, "America was born a Christian nation. America was born to exemplify that devotion to the elements of righteousness which are derived from the Holy Scriptures." The opening words of both our Constitution and the Declaration of Independence affirm a belief in God as the creator and sustainer of life. These are the principles that have made America great and enabled our pioneers to draft the liberties which we have so long enjoyed here. Such a trend has not been maintained in our government, however. In fact, there are cunningly devised organizations now in operation whose sole aim is to destroy our religious heritage and make us an atheistic nation. One such organization is UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. The United Nations Charter authorized that body to promote the formation of an affiliated agency for educational and cultural development. It was at a conference in London, November 1945, that the UNESCO Constitution was developed. Since that time, American taxpayers have paid almost one-third of the cost of UNESCO. In the year 1960, according to the 8th Report on United States Contributions to International Organizations, submitted by the State Department to the United States House of Representatives, the United States contribution to UNESCO was $3,789,810. The 1961 estimate is $3,832,952, an increase of over $43,000. Since its beginning, United States taxpayers have given UNESCO $133,314,410. If we are paying all of this money, we ought to be getting something in return that's good for America. In their propaganda, UNESCO says that one of its chief purposes is to contribute to peace and security. In order to do this, UNESCO holds conferences, conducts studies, and disseminates what they call factual information on the natural sciences, social sciences, cultural activities, and related ideas. Their actual activity, however, is quite another thing. Former Senator William Benton expressed the purpose of UNESCO in these words at the first meeting of the United States National Commission for UNESCO, September 23, 1946. I quote, "We are at the beginning of a long process of breaking down the walls of national sovereignty. In this process, UNESCO can be, and indeed must be, the pioneer. You give, for the first time in our history, a collective brain to the whole nervous system of American science and culture, education, and means of communication." End of quote. Milton Eisenhower, in a speech in Wichita, Kansas in 1949, had this to add concerning UNESCO. "One can truly understand UNESCO only if one views it in its historical context. And viewed in this way, it reveals itself as one more step in our halting, painful, but I think very real, progress toward a genuine world government." End of quote. Now, I don't think that this could be made any plainer. Americans, you and I, have paid, since inception of UNESCO, over $133 million to destroy our constitutional form of government and bring us under a great one-world system, a one-world government. One of the means devised to bring about this breakdown of nationalism in America is through the school system. This is outlined in a series of 9 volumes entitled Toward World Understanding. This series is aimed at instructing kindergarten and elementary school teachers in preparing our children for the day when their loyalty will be to a world government instead of to God and the American form of government. In booklet 5 of this study, the teachers are told, and I quote, "Before the child enters school, his mind has already been profoundly marked by earlier influences. The earlier years may be indispensable to the education of children for world citizenship. The kindergarten and infant school can prepare the child for membership in a world society. As long as the child breathes the poison air of nationalism, education in world-mindedness can produce only precarious results." End of quote. In the Kremlin-dominated nations, the children are taken from their parents and raised by the state. This is true of China and Cuba as well. In America, things are not quite that easy, so the teachers must be told what to teach even the very youngest in order to overcome the nationalistic trends of their more patriotic parents, at the expense of these very parents, of course. But the UNESCO indoctrination program is not confined only to the elementary grades. Their latest project is a history book, which was completed at the end of 1960. As far as we know, the book is now in use in some of our nation's high schools. It is entitled, A History of the Scientific and Cultural Development of Mankind. This project was set in motion by Joseph Needham, a British Marxist who supported the communist lie that the United States used germ warfare in Korea. A.A. Zvorkin of the Soviet Union is a vice president of the commission, and 13 other representatives from the Soviet Union are corresponding members or consultants. There are 3 representatives from communist Hungary, 3 from Poland, 3 from Czechoslovakia, and 2 from Yugoslavia. The final editor of the history and a vice president of the commission is a citizen of the United States named Ralph E. Turner. Among the other 25 members from the United States who are working on the book are extreme left-wingers such as Arthur Schlesinger and John A. Fairbank. The famous atheist, Julian Huxley, formerly the first director of UNESCO, is a vice president of this particular commission. Huxley made his position clear when he said, "I do not believe in a god or gods." The Intelligence Digest of London, England, quoted him as saying, "Operationally, God is beginning to resemble, not a ruler, but the last fading smile of a cosmic Cheshire cat." End of quote. The well-known British crackpot, Bertrand Russell, who is often involved in pro-communist moves to disarm the free world, is also connected with this book. It is unthinkable that American history, with its heroic and sacrificial love for both God and country, will receive an unbiased review from such distorted minds. Most informed Americans will remember well the treasonable activities of the Institute for Pacific Relations. After hearing testimony which ran into thousands of pages, the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee reported in 1952, quote, "The Institute for Pacific Relations was a vehicle used by the communists to orientate American far eastern policies toward communist objectives. Members of the small corps of officials and staff members who controlled the Institute of Pacific Relations were either communist or pro-communist. The American Communist Party and Soviet officials considered the organization an instrument of communist policy, propaganda, and military intelligence." End of quote. Yet, when the Institute for Pacific Relations met to consider disbanding, they gave the following as one of the reasons, as reported in the radical left-wing Washington Post. Quote, "The work it," that is the Institute of Pacific Relations, "set out to do is now being duplicated by wealthier and better equipped world organizations such as the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO." End of quote. Now let's go back and reconsider what I said earlier, that the main purpose of the Institute of Pacific Relations was to orientate American policies toward communist objectives. This is what the wealthier UNESCO is now doing in place of the Institute of Pacific Relations. These unpleasant facts about UNESCO are heightened by its measure of acceptance within our nation. UNESCO booklets are distributed by the National Education Association and the PTA to students and teachers. UNESCO literature is issued through the YMCA, churches, radio and television outlets, newspapers, magazines, civic groups, and through government sources. As insidious as the Institute of Pacific Relations activities were, UNESCO is even more cunning and firmly entrenched. It is no secret that Cuban history is being rewritten to falsify historical facts. Hate America propaganda is being placed in the classrooms and is being taught by the teachers. For example, the United States, and I quote from a piece of their literature, went into the Spanish-American War not to help Cuba, but simply for selfish ends, end of quote. In a report to member states, which every UNESCO nation must make, in Paris, September 1960, Red Cuba said this, "Law 680 was promulgated to lay the foundations of a new, more rational and effective general system of education. UNESCO experts have cooperated in this great task." End of quote. Thus, all of the lying, deceiving, hateful propaganda promoted by Castro and his red regime was cooperated in by the United Nations organization UNESCO, of which the United States pays almost one-third of the cost. UNESCO has a tactic which is also employed by the National Council of Churches. It is called resolutions. The governing body drafts the resolutions, and in a matter of time, they become directives. In the UNESCO reports of member states, 1958, we read this, "The whole of the information, opinions, and appraisals in the reports reproduced in this volume emanate from member states which are alone responsible for them." End of quote. Now let's consider the little country of Malaya and their objection to UNESCO. This Federation of Malaya became an official member of the UNESCO family in June 1958. But it didn't swallow the UNESCO line like other members have. At the end of the Malaya report, we read, there is too much waste of time and the taxpayers' money. They further objected to the strings which UNESCO attaches to the funds which they dispense. Malaya wrote, and I quote, this country would appreciate it very much if UNESCO could offer scholarships for Malayan painters or musicians to study in Europe without requiring the assurance that they would be given a job on their return. The condition that we should promise employment prevents this government from sponsoring the most suitable candidates, end of quote. The problem, it seems, is that those whom Malaya considered the most capable were not of the political persuasion so necessary for UNESCO aid. Those whom UNESCO had indoctrinated in one worldism were not the type that Malaya felt worthy of jobs when they returned from their study abroad. Under the heading Exchange of Persons, Malaya made further criticisms of the UNESCO program. The University of Malaya was informed of the possibility of taking advantage of study abroad. However, it appears that it is not possible at present to take advantage of the project. Perhaps the most popular project would be grants for appreciation of Western and Eastern culture. The most serious obstacle to our taking advantage of this scheme is that UNESCO has stipulated the condition that we should undertake to employ these scholars on their return to this country. Another difficulty is that the amount given to the scholar seems to be insufficient to support a student while abroad, end of quote. The small Malayan nation has seen through the UNESCO schemes and rightly surmises that fewer scholarships which pay the full cost of the student would be of more value. But UNESCO, being a political organization, has no interest in education, science, or culture in the pure. Lillian Moore Roberts, an expert on UNESCO subversion, has listed several guideposts for those who would